Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 111, Warming Trend, Thursday, February 25th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode includes the following segments: The Back Porch, The Front Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, and Off the Shelf. Hello, everyone. I hope you're doing well. Today presented an unexpected opportunity to record a podcast episode since my school district used one of its snow days for what was actually torrential rain that caused a large power outage in the school district where I work. So I hope everyone is okay and doing well and that we'll be back in business again tomorrow. But today I just saw a window of opportunity, and since I didn't get to record last weekend, I thought I would catch you up on some of the progress I have made. On the back porch is Thistle. It's a scarf pattern designed by Tin Can Knits, and it's divided into one third of a beautiful thistle motif, quite a challenging lace pattern. And then the other two thirds of the length of the scarf are a beautiful column lace that is in a sort of a tighter gauge, but it's a very easy to memorize pattern that is not as challenging to knit. So this morning I completed the knitting and bound off, and I also blocked this scarf. It's drying now. I used two skeins of Mirasol Sulca Legato, which is a silk and alpaca blend in the color lilac, and I knit this on US4 needles. I'm very excited to see how this turns out once blocked. I didn't pin this lace out. I just stretched it to the size that was indicated on the pattern and left it to dry. And I think since my blocking squares have a little bit of a pile or a nap on them, that they will retain their shape. The length and width will be maintained by the blocking squares that I use, and it will dry without the necessity for pinning. This thistle scarf is part of a wardrobe idea that I had to make during this month, the month of February, and its pairing is a dress pattern in a thistle fabric, and I have not yet begun working on that garment. So this weekend will be my final opportunity if I want to stay on track with my handmade wardrobe. The other thing I completed this week is a project that has been a long time in the making. When I attended the Super Summer Knit Together in August of 2014, I spent a little bit of time on the yarn truck sponsored by House of Yarn. And from the beautiful Meg, I bought some locally dyed roving. It's a merino bamboo blend, I think 60% merino, 40% bamboo. And it was in this Q fall soft gradient, which went from beautiful deep gold through some blues and then into a silvery gray. And all of the fiber had quite a bit of sheen to it because of the bamboo content. I began spinning this on my drop spindle, a Lark spindle from Jenkins Yarn Tools. I divided the braid into thirds. Each color made up roughly a third of the braid. And then I divided each section of color in two because my eventual goal was to make this into a two-ply yarn. I have not worked on this project steadily, but from time to time, for spells of a few months or so, I would pick it up when I was doing meditative spindling and made very slow, but I guess somewhat steady progress on spinning this entire braid on the drop spindle. I think that spindle spun yarn has an incredible softness to it, which does not make it incredibly durable, but it's really lovely for a shawl. So finally, I completed all of the spindling and I had six turtles, two of each color portion of the braid, and then I did ply them together on my Louette wheel. I came up with 433 yards of a fingering weight yarn, perfect for a shawl, and this washed and dried just so soft and beautiful. It's very lofty so that the braid seems sort of very big and puffy, even though there's not an incredible amount of yardage. I think the braid was just over 4 ounces, but I don't exactly remember. So finally, after several years, I think I started this in December of 2014 and completed it this month. A long-term project has graduated to the back porch. Of course, I have begun another spindling project because I always like to have something on one of my drop spindles, and I try to make some time to work on spindling every day if I can. This past Saturday was the second session of Sheep to Shawl with the Fibercraft Studio in Chestnut Ridge, New York. I have signed on for another year of the course, and I'm working on deepening my experience. So I've thought a lot about how to plan ahead, because one of the challenges I faced last year was with just spinning a little bit of yarn at a time and dyeing something this color and dyeing something that color and not really having any amount of consistency or quantity in the things that I made. I did have a pretty big hurdle to overcome at the end of the course when I was challenged to put all of those things together into one project. A project that I frogged this past weekend. I haven't worn the poncho that I made for my Sheep to Shawl class since completing it in early December. I've thought about wearing it, I've put it on, but I've never left the house wearing this garment. And I took a very long, hard look at it and thought very carefully. And after a good long think, I just admitted to myself that really the design of this project was poor. It was way too long across and not really deep enough to work comfortably as a poncho, at least comfortably for me. I always felt like I wanted more fabric in one place and less in another. So I unpicked the closure and I unraveled the project and wound the yarn into a very large, very loose ball. I didn't want to work any of the loft out of the yarn, so I wound it nice and loose into a big ball, and I think I would like to re-knit this project by casting on fewer stitches and maybe thinking about how to alter the design in a couple of other ways. But thinking about how to correct that deficit of not planning ahead this year. Since I know the shape and the scope of the course, I think I can spin more thoughtfully, and then I can make more yarn of a particular quality, and it will be easier to knit up at the end of the course. Last year, one of my classmates, Bridget, gave each of us really as much as we wanted of some beautiful black alpaca. It's very short staple, but it's incredibly soft. And I had probably nearly 4 ounces of this black alpaca. And I started using hand cards to blend black alpaca with a very dark Jacob wool. Spinning the alpaca on its own is a challenge that I'm just not interested in undertaking right now. But I was able to combine about 50% alpaca, 50% wool into rolags that are relatively easy to spin, and they're yielding a beautifully soft, wonderful two-ply yarn. So I made rolags to equal between 3 and 4 ounces. I just worked very slowly and very carefully on my hand cards and blended everything into rolags. I was weighing the quantities of alpaca and wool so that I would get a consistent blend throughout. So I used my little digital scale, and I would have 2 ounces of alpaca and 2 ounces of the Jacob, and then blend them together. So over the course of the next few months, I will be spinning those rolags on my Aegean spindle from Jenkins Yarn Tools, and most likely I will ply those on my Louette wheel. I find that I really like a yarn that is plied with a low amount of twist, spun with a low amount of twist and plied with a higher amount of twist. This seems to me to give a nice springy yarn with a lot of loft, and it doesn't get string-like. I think when you spin the singles with a whole lot of twist, which is typical for a beginning spinner because you feel like the yarn is going to pull apart if you don't put enough twist on it, and then it tends to be a little bit overspun. And then if you take that same amount of twist and put it into the ply, you're getting a very dense, almost a hard yarn. If you don't ply it enough, then it doesn't really look like yarn. It looks like singles that happen to be sitting next to each other. So I find that that combination of a low amount of twist in the single and a little more twist in the ply makes a very pleasant yarn to knit with. And this is coming up because of the loft, it's sort of between a fingering weight and a sport weight. And I hope to get quite a bit of yardage on this yarn. I'm thinking with that nice dark color, if I have some pops of other naturally dyed yarn, it could be a really beautiful cowl or maybe even a shawl. I'm not sure. I'll see how much yardage I come up with. So that is one project that's on the front porch and will be ongoing for probably quite a while. And the other is one that I will begin this evening. I will be winding some yarn for one of the two projects I mentioned that were in my queue. It's called Hediye, and it's by Isolde Teague. Hediye is Turkish for gift or a present. And this is a beautiful shawl knit in DK weight yarn. It has a border, a cabled border that's knit first, and then you pick up stitches to knit the center of the shawl. I have never used this type of structure for a shawl before, so this will be new for me. And it just looks like a very versatile and warm and really stunning shawl. And I will be using some DK weight yarn that I'm pretty excited about. For the border of this shawl, I will be using some beautiful DK weight yarn from a local to me farm called Pondwood Farm. I believe this is a Romney blend. I can't remember, and I took a photo only of the front of the ball band, so I'll have to report back on that. And then for the center of the shawl, I will be using a recent purchase from my local yarn store. From Ba Ram U, I'm using Dovestone DK in the rhubarb colorway. So the border will be a beautiful, natural, deep brown, and then the center will be this vibrant pinkish color. And then I have a little bit of yarn left over from a previous project that's in a pumpkin gold color. And I think I will use that, I don't have very much of it, for just a pop of color between the border and the center portion of the shawl. So it'll just give a little bit of interest there. I was thinking this week that I haven't done a giveaway on the podcast for quite a while, and so I thought that this episode I would mention a Just Because giveaway, and then I will announce the winners on episode 112 when I record it, probably in about a week. The giveaway is for either one of the two patterns I said I would be knitting in the near future. So one is Hedi by Isolde Teague, and the other, which I believe I will begin knitting probably in April or May, is Paper Cranes by Lori Versace. Paper Cranes is in a fingering weight. I think you could also knit it in a lace weight, and it has more of a warm weather feel to it. One of the reasons I decided to hold off a little bit on the paper cranes is that I haven't decided on the yarn and I don't have yarn in stash to knit this project. It requires over 1,000 yards. And the other is that I think paper cranes will lend itself more to early summer and summertime wearing. And I was thinking about maybe something that's a silk blend yarn. I haven't quite decided. But I had the yarn in mind for Hedi, and so I'm going to work on that one in March. If you're interested in winning either one of these patterns, I hope you will head on over to the giveaway thread in the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry and post a little bit there about a gift you treasure or maybe a knitted gift that you have given away. And let me know which of these two patterns is of most interest to you. Ever-expanding skill set. Well, I mentioned that I have enrolled in another year of Sheep to Shawl. And even though the general trajectory of the year-long course is the same as it was last year, there are some different activities. And it seems each year that there are several people. I think there are four of us who are repeating the course this time around. And so the activities change and shift a little bit because of the availability of the instructors, and also I think to maintain the attention of folks who are repeating the course. Each year we do some activities focused on thinking deeply about color. Last year we did some work with pastels, and this year we are doing a three-part watercolor course. The course will be divided into three sessions. We started last weekend with warm colors, and then we'll work with cool colors, and then we will work also with neutrals. I have not done any watercolor painting so certainly as an adult. And I was thinking back to my art classes in middle school and a little bit in high school, and I don't really recall working with watercolors. One of the reasons that was triggered for me is that the instructor put the watercolor paper in water, and then we sort of squeegeed it off with a sponge and then painted on the wet paper. Maybe that's a technique that isn't typically used with watercolors, but I certainly never remember doing that. And I think the sensory details of doing that would certainly have stuck with me, and I would recall it. So we talked a lot about blending color, colors coming forward, colors moving back, and in watercolor, filling an area with color rather than trying to draw something or focusing on line. The teacher was incredibly informative, patient, and kind. And so even though there was such a steep learning curve for me in working with watercolor, I really did feel comfortable and curious and eager to work with the color. And it was in a very different way than we had been thinking about color with the pastels last year. So all week I've been thinking about color and warm color, which really isn't part of our landscape right now. So it takes a lot of power of mind, but I find myself recognizing warm colors and distinguishing them from cool colors as I'm looking at many different kinds of things, from clothing to interiors to just objects to vehicles on my commute. And so I think yet again, this course is capturing my attention and getting me to slow down and think about the connections between things. And it's not something that will necessarily inform my fiber arts practice directly, but I think that continued exposure to different kinds of thinking certainly enhances my understanding of what I'm doing when I'm working with color. Also expanding my skill set this month, I have been continuing on the hashtag Power Pantry endeavor to cook with a different ingredient each month and maybe make some old favorites, but also really try some new things and some new recipes. And this month, I have been very grateful to Linda. She's ex-farm girl on Ravelry. She posted what she said was an oldie but a goodie recipe for jam bars. And in these kinds of recipes, there are several that I've seen online now that I understand what the recipe is all about. You can sort of see that it's a type of recipe. So you make what is at once a dough and a topping by cutting butter into assorted ingredients. In this case, there's flour, brown sugar, oatmeal, and then you divide that mixture. You press the majority of it into a pan, and then you melt or heat up some jam and jelly or a mixture of the two. And you spread that on top of the crust, and then you put the remainder of the mixture on top as a topping. In my case, I added a little more butter to the topping, and I also added coconut flakes. I think you could add nuts to this mixture, and that would also be good. The recipe said put things into an 8x12 pan or an 8x8 pan. I used my humongous 9x13 pan, and there was plenty of ingredients. It didn't come out like a skimpy batch of jam bars at all. There's plenty in the recipe for a big set of servings. And these baked up beautifully, and they cut very neatly, and they're delicious. So I could see myself really having this as like a tried and true recipe that you could put any number of things for the filling and change up the topping a little bit. There's something everyone would love, and they travel well. They also store well, although we didn't get to store them very long because they're already gone. Finally, this month, I've been trying to think up a way to make the most of this bacon marmalade that I have in my cupboard, had in my cupboard, and was given to me as a gift around the holidays. And one day on the way to work, I just thought about how Samuel and I love to eat bacon-wrapped scallops that we do on our grill in the summertime. And I thought, oh, wouldn't that be a great pairing if I made a glaze out of some of this bacon marmalade and I drizzled it over scallops to get that bacon-wrapped scallops essence. So that's what we did, and we served it over some really nice risotto with some roasted asparagus. So there was like the sweetness, a little bit cheesy, the bitterness of the asparagus, a little bit of saltiness. It was a fantastic meal. So I think this works great as a condiment. We used about half the jar in the recipe. And now I don't know what we'll do with the rest. I keep half expecting that it will just, we'll just be eating it by the spoonful, and then soon enough it will be all gone. But maybe it will stick around and we can use it for another recipe. March is coming up, and in March, the featured ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry will be lemons. I love lemons for their brightness and for their ability to bring out the flavor in lots of other foods. I also love a tart lemon flavor to things, both sweet and savory. So I have already started a thread on the Yarns at Yinhoo board for March and lemons. Hopefully this interests you and you will be willing to share recipes, photographs, links, and your ideas for cooking with lemons. I'm also thinking that lemon curd and preserved lemons will be possibilities for ingredients this month. And I'm really looking forward to it. I think with the coming of spring, the cooking that I do tends to lighten up a little bit. And I think lemons are also great with all kinds of fresh spring vegetables, early spring vegetables like peas and mint and maybe early asparagus in some cases. So it should be a lot of fun to experiment with lemons in March. Off the shelf. To conclude our month of cooking together with jams and jellies, I thought I would share an excerpt from a piece I've read recently when a dear friend sent me this beautiful book. It's an anthology called American Food Writing, edited by Molly O'Neill. It's an anthology with some recipes in it as well. And the piece I'm reading from today is called Enough Jam for a Lifetime by Maxine Kumin. In the introduction about Maxine Kumin, the editor Molly O'Neill writes, "More than anything, the power of cooking lies in connection. It connects people to places, one generation to another, and in the case of something seasonal, like the jam making that the poet Maxine Kumin describes here, it revives lost memories. Here, she makes enough jam for a lifetime. And making it takes long enough to recall a lifetime. Born and raised in Philadelphia, Kumin, who was born in 1925 and won a Pulitzer in 1973, she has published many novels and volumes of poetry and has been known for her crystalline focus on daily life and her bond with the landscapes of New England, tendencies that have deepened since 1976 when she and her husband moved to a farm in Warner, New Hampshire. So this is an essay, but I think the poetic tendencies of Maxine Kumin come through. And she talks about an amazing, fruitful season of berry picking, and then her mother's suggestion that instead of trying to can and preserve all of the bounty just then, they put some of that fruit into the freezer, and then you could make it into jam in the wintertime. This wintry day, then, I reduce 5 gallons of blackberries to serviceable pulp, measure out 3 cups of sugar to every 4 of berry mash, and set it boiling. We will have successive batches on the stove the rest of this day. I have already rummaged for suitable jars from the cellar shelves, and these I will boil for 15 minutes on a back burner. Toward the end, I will grow more inventive about jars, for there are never enough of the good, straight-sided variety. But for now, the jam puts up lacy bubbles, rolling around the top third of my giant cooking pot at a full boil. Despite candy thermometers, the only way I trust to gauge when the jam is ready is dip and drip. From a decent height off a slotted spoon, I perform this test until the royal stuff begins to form a tiny waterfall. This is known as sheeting. All the cookbooks describe it, but it's a delicate decision to arrive at. Stop too soon and you have a lovely blackberry sauce to serve over ice cream, sponge cake, or applesauce. Continue too long and you have a fatally overcooked mess of berry leather. There is no quality control in my method. Every batch is a kind of revisionism. It makes its own laws, but the result is pure, deeply colored, uncomplicated, and unadulterated blackberry jam, veritably seedless, suitable for every occasion. After it has cooled, I pour melted paraffin on top of it, tilting the glass to get an airproof seal. Modern science frowns on so casual an approach to shutting out microbes, but I don't apologize. If the wax shows a spot of mold growing on it after a few months on the shelf, I can always remove it, wipe the sides clean, and pour a new layer of wax over all. My mother would go home from her summer visits with a package of pickles and jams for her later delectation. When she died, there were several unopened jars in her cupboard. I took them back with me after the funeral. We ate them in her stead, as she would have wanted us to. Enough jam for a lifetime, she would say, with evident satisfaction after a day of scullery duty. It was. It is.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire, just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a